Mr. Anderson, we have a copy of your letter citing Herring versus Commonwealth, and even before that letter, we have read the case and are familiar with it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, would you like to reserve any rebuttal?
Yes, please, Your Honor. May I reserve 5 minutes?
Sure. All right, so you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Colston Jones from the Office of the Public Defender here in Chesapeake. And I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Jonathan Keyes. And just because it's unusual, I would like to let the court know that Mr. Keyes is present here in the audience this morning. There are three assignments of error in this case, just each attacking the conviction for abduction in the matter. The first two are closely related. They challenge whether or not a detention of the complaining witness was in fact established. And the second is challenging whether the evidence was sufficient to prove that Mr. Keyes ever formed an intent to deprive Ms. Wolf of her personal liberty. And finally, there's an issue of Mr. Keyes is acting with legal justification or excuse, and that he was acting primarily to exclude the police from entering his home on the...
But the legal justification or excuse has to be a legal justification of depriving the victim of her personal liberty, not anybody else.
I think it would be fair to view it, Your Honor, though, as it is an affirmative defense that the defendant is required to bear the burden of proof on, but in acting in accordance with his right to exclude the police from his home, and as a consequence, there may have been difficulty for Ms. Wolf to leave the residence while he was acting within his justification to refuse entry to the police.
And you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Perhaps since the court has mentioned it already, and I do commend Mr. Anderson for bringing to my attention that recent decision of the Supreme Court in Herring. I would note, Your Honor, that there's a factual distinction between the Herring matter in this case. In the Supreme Court's recent opinion, they did discuss at some length that the defendant in that matter had made a specific threat to one of the children in that matter who was alleged to have been a victim of the abduction. I don't believe that there's a specific threat of anything in this record before us today that Mr. Keyes had made to Ms. Wolf. And also of note in that new case recently decided on the 5th of June, there is a footnote that discusses whether a parent would have that legal justification or excuse to detain the children. I think it's footnote 3, but it does note that neither party in the Herring case had briefed or argued that issue, so it was deemed waived, but it did seem significant to me that it was mentioned in a footnote that issue had not been brought to the merits.
I think the threat in Herring was to his wife, who was outside the house. I don't think that there was a threat to the children. I was on the Herring panel in our court, so I'm kind of familiar with the facts, but
yes,
it's been a while.
Just under sort of the subsection that's letter B in the recent Supreme Court opinion, it does say that Tony, and by that I believe is referred to the defendant, that he had told at least one of his daughters that he was going to shoot her, her sister, her brother, her grandfather, and himself.
Okay.
So that's what I'm referring to specifically, Your Honor, and that's I do believe a significant distinction from the cases before us this morning. Another, I think, significant issue in this matter is just that there are several sort of discrete events that are alleged to provide some evidence in support of the abduction charge, but they do occur sort of over a span of time. There's first the matter with the walker, then that's preceded by the alleged striking, which of course Mr. Keyes testified never occurred, and then finally the matter of the cell phone. And all of that are just separate and discrete events which do precede
and the crutches.
Yes, Your Honor. Those events which I just mentioned had preceded the arrival of the police, and then, of course, the crutches subsequent to their arrival. But as I noted in the brief, Your Honor, it does appear that Ms. Wolf certainly testified that she was able to leave the apartment without difficulty, presumably because removing the crutch was easily performed at the time that she did ultimately leave the building that evening.
Does the hour and a half time span, is that relevant? Should we consider that in terms of her being deprived of personal liberty?
I think of greater significance, though, Your Honor, I would say is that something that was addressed by this court in the Herring decision, an unpublished opinion, that I think is unfortunately not fully addressed in the recent Supreme Court decision, is the ability of the alleged victim to move within the house, to maintain contact with other people, either by telephone or, in this case, through the window and freely speaking with the police officers.
Of course, the cell phone was broken.
Yes.
And there was no landline.
That's so, Your Honor. And then what's interesting with particular regard to that is that Ms. Wolf's testimony was just that the phone was thrown and that it later didn't work. It was Mr. Keyes, in his testimony, in his own defense, where he admitted to breaking the cell phone, and he testified that his reason for doing so was that he found Ms. Wolf to have been exchanging text messages with her ex-boyfriend, which made him angry. Even viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, that seems to be a credible explanation of his action in breaking the cell phone. And as I say, Ms. Wolf didn't testify to any specific breaking of the cell phone. She did say that it was thrown, and after that it wouldn't work properly. But it wasn't a matter where she described a deliberate smashing.
What difference does that make, whether he broke it with a decent reason or without a reason? It deprived her of communication ability, and that's what the question was about. She didn't have any way to communicate.
She didn't have any way to communicate by telephone, that's true, but she was...
So what difference does it make if he broke it because he didn't like who she'd been calling or just did it for meanness?
I suppose that that any and all facts that are established to have occurred at the time of this offense could be viewed as probative of the intent, which is a specific intent in this case under the statute, and of course is an essential element of the offense that's charged.
Counsel, let me recite what I understand the facts to be, and you tell me whether you agree or disagree.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
All right. The defendant broke the cell phone and there was no landline.
Yes, Your Honor.
That he blocked the stairs so she couldn't go downstairs.
I would agree that he refused to move, and I think that's why the circuit court case from Newport News, although certainly not binding on this court, is relevant. Just a refusal to move, even if it obstructs another person's ability to move freely, may not rise to the level.
She was incapacitated.
She had some limited mobility that, of course, is not chargeable to my client. She had a medical injury.
And initially, he wouldn't let her out of the bedroom.
I think, again, he stood between her and the door, but I don't believe that even Ms. Wolf testified as to a specific word or threat or anything of that nature that would have allowed us to know that for certain.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir.
You may proceed.
For all those reasons, Your Honor, we're asking the court to certainly to reverse the decision of the trial court and to vacate the conviction in this matter. Happy to respond to any further questions, but I would like to reserve.
Do you have any other questions?
Thank you.
Remainder
you
of my time.
You have 6.5 minutes left.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. May it please the court, I think that the sufficiency of the evidence was already pretty apparent in this case, but I think the Supreme Court of Virginia's recent decision, not quite 2 weeks ago, in the Herring opinion, in which it reversed this court's holding on this particular aspect of its two opinions and held that the evidence was sufficient to sustain the abduction convictions, makes that conclusion quite clear. Now, first, as per Herring and some of the cases I cited on brief, there are two discrete elements of abduction, but they are related, and proof of one can be used as proof of the other. One is whether there's a detention. Second, whether the defendant intended to deprive the victim of their personal liberty, and that's an an issue, intent is an issue of fact, and like any other factual finding, on appeal is enforceable if it's fairly supported by the record or not plainly wrong. I think it's clear that this is a bench trial, and the trial judge is finding a fact here, I think, is plainly supported by the record. The judge referred to several of the circumstances in denying the motion to strike that led him to the conclusion there was an abduction. First, the victim was virtually immobile due to this recent broken ankle. I mean, even the defendant himself said he had to help her, and it took him 25 minutes to go up the stairs. That is, by the way, unlike anything in the Harrington case, which put aside the fact it's circuit court opinion, and certainly it's not at the same level of significance as decisions of this court or the Supreme Court of Virginia, but if it was a Supreme Court of Virginia case, the fact is you had no equivalent immobility of the victim in that case. Also, the judge here talked about the fact that the defendant physically abused the victim. He slapped her several times. He kicked her three times. By the way, in the Herring case, which in some ways is factually pretty similar to what you have here, but the factual distinctions in just about every instance strengthen the conclusion in the case at bar that there was an abduction, because in Herring there was no physical touching of any of the abduction victims. Here you have the slapping and the three kickings, and the judge pointed that out. The judge also pointed out to the fact that the defendant added, you have this woman's immobility, which is almost total, and counsel talked about her easily leaving the house. She didn't do anything easily physically at this time, nothing. Now, the record makes that abundantly clear. But the defendant grabbed the cell phone, threw it. It didn't work anymore. And as Judge Bumgardner has indicated, if it didn't work, it just added to her isolation. Now, she was admittedly able to call to talk to the police outside her open bedroom window, but that's not terribly different than the fact that one of the daughters in the Herring case was on the phone for a sustained period of time with 911 operators, and this court seemed to think that that was, in its initial opinion in Herring, that that somehow undercut the conclusion there was an abduction, and that argument by the defendant went nowhere in the Supreme Court. By the way, counsel talked about that the victim's limited mobility, quote, isn't chargeable to my client. Well, it's not chargeable in the sense that he didn't break her ankle. That's certainly true. But in terms of his intent and what he did and what he knew, if he knew she could barely walk, that certainly goes to his mindset in doing what he did. And also, so the judge in denying the motion to strike appropriately talked about this combination of behavior of Mr. Keyes was the ultimate force that deprived her of her liberty. But you have other circumstances as well. When the police came, Keyes told the victim that no one would answer the door or let them in. He made threatening statements to the police at the very get-go that he was armed and he would shoot Officer Hill. That is somewhat equivalent to the situation in Herring, where the defendant made threats to kill his wife, and then, being a man of his word, he went back to the bedroom, retrieved a gun, which caused her to flee outside, hide under her father-in-law's pickup truck, and he fired a shot. And that was that separately resulted in his own convictions for attempted murder and firearm counts against her. That was also upheld by the Supreme Court. But the threats against her and the deeds against her were somewhat equivalent to the threats here against the police officers. By the way, in Herring, one of the big arguments, which found some success in this court but not in the Supreme Court, was that all these actions were against the wife. And admittedly, certainly most of what went on was against the wife, not the four abduction victims. Here, there's only one other person in the house, which is the victim. So you don't have any attenuation issue to deal with the way you did in Herring. But it is true, and I think this came out during counsel's initial argument, that the Supreme Court did point out that, in fact, the defendant at one point made a threat where he said he's going to kill all of the abduction victims as well as himself. And then when his father, who was one of the abduction victims, said he was going to leave, He said, well, I'm going to have to kill you. So the Supreme Court did point that out. But again, in the case of Barr, all of the acts, all of the words were directed against this one and only other person in the home. Also, this is one situation, one circumstance different from Herring. In Herring, the children locked themselves in a bedroom. Here, the victim, Ms. Wolf, was not able to lock herself in the bedroom. That's at page 48 of the appendix. So between the two, she had less security, if that's the right word to use. You have one circumstance here that I think plainly shows detention, plainly shows, at least in terms of an appellate court affirming the trier facts, finding a fact about intent, that trumps anything in Herring. In this particular case, it's a small town, a very small townhouse. That was the characterization of it. And the victim, I think the police at this point were just trying to see if she could leave. So she made her way to the top of the stairs, which is the one and only way to get downstairs. And the defendant blocks her from doing it. He's in a position where she has no way to get past him, particularly because of her immobility. There's not some other set of stairs she could take. And the Harrington case, they talked about the fact that the victim there, who was, again, did not have a problem with mobility such as here, there was nothing to prevent that victim from going out the front door of the home. Here, the one and only way to get downstairs was at a point where the defendant was making that impossible to happen. So, not surprisingly, the defendant's brief, I think it's at page 10, talks about he prevented her from going downstairs. Well, if he prevented her from going downstairs, one, that has to be called a detention, and two, the trier facts finding that he had the intent to keep her up there, to keep her from going downstairs, is surely adequately supported by the record. Judge Frank also indicated about whether the length of the incident is probative, and I think it plainly is, and that's another circumstance that is equivalent to Herring, where in each case the incident lasted, I think here an hour and a half, there is probably even longer. Finally, there is another circumstance that is similar in that after this protracted seizure, the defendant in each case ultimately let, in Herring's case, his father, here the victim, the only victim, go out and leave the home. That, I think, was mentioned by this court's initial opinion in Herring as significant. The argument was made in the Supreme Court. Again, it was unavailing. And it makes sense. If you have a detention that's gone on for an hour and a half, you have a detention no matter whether at some point thereafter the defendant abandons the intent to keep depriving them of their liberties. I mean, the Virginia Supreme Court case in Collins with the out-of-state bail sponsman, which I've cited on brief, is indicative of that. So the abandonment of any intent to detain here came was too little, too late. Finally, on the issue about the two elements of the abduction, this claimed ability of the victim to move throughout the residence is factually not well taken. She couldn't move freely at all, given her immobility. It also ignores his threats and physical acts of abuse against her and is no more valid an argument than the equivalent argument that was made in Herring, that the fact that several of the victims could talk to the 911 operators and supposedly could move within the house show that there was no abduction there. Just one last thing before I briefly go to the other issue. The only argument by the defendant on brief as to why his preventing Wolf from going down the stairs, the incident I've described, was not abduction, is his reliance on Harrington. But again, there was nothing to prevent that healthy victim from going out some other, the front door of the home. I mean, so for all we know, the defendant there was just trying to be an obnoxious jerk, but he did not actually have the ability to prevent that person from leaving of the sort that was plainly evidenced here. Just briefly on this issue about whether the defendant acted with legal justification or excuse, presumably, if you're going to pigeonhole it, the argument would be that he had a legal justification to keep the police from coming in. But whatever ability he had to keep the police from coming in certainly didn't give him an equivalent right to keep this woman that he'd physically abused inside. The one doesn't follow from the other. And I think as Judge Frank indicated, wouldn't the justification focus on the victim, not others? And I think that's another way of saying what I've just said. I mean, plainly here, under the abduction statute, there's an abduction if the defendant acts, quote, without legal justification or excuse. Well, there was no such justification or excuse here. I would just point out, as I've said on brief, that many of the actions here that show the abduction were committed before the police ever even arrived at the scene. The defendant also said, this is at pages 69 and 70, that his motive in trying to keep the police out was to avoid an arrest for being drunk in public. That's hardly some clarion call to say to the police, you're not going to act in some kind of heavy-handed way of being some improper agent of the state. He just said he didn't want to be arrested for being drunk in public. And he also relies upon his own discredited testimony that he was, in effect, the voice of reason. Is that you have a warrant? I mean, according to both the victim and the police officer, the first words out of his mouth were, you're not coming in here, and he threatened to kill the officer, and he repeatedly said he was armed, and they didn't know one way or another whether he was. So there's plainly not evidence here to support an affirmative defense. The defendant certainly didn't produce evidence sufficient to raise a reasonable doubt. But again, the simplest way to reject that claim is whatever rights he had to keep the police out certainly were not coextensive with his right to keep this woman that he physically attacked and intimidated in. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
Only briefly, I just would note that on the page 39 of the joint appendix, Ms. Wolf said that she had never seen a weapon that day or any other day in Mr. Key's possession. So even though she heard those comments that he made to the police officer, she certainly knew that he wasn't capable of carrying them out. Certainly it can be distinguished from Herring on that regard, because the defendant in Herring had not only the shotgun that he fired, but also an additional firearm. So that certainly makes his threats to kill the victims of the abduction much more credible, much more serious, and certainly much more probative of an abduction, where he's threatened to one of the abduction victims that he will shoot them all and himself. So I think that is a huge and significant distinction between this matter and Herring. In addition, just with regard to the comment about not wanting to be arrested for being drunk in public, I'm not sure that the motivation for exercising his right to exclude the police from his home is probative one way or the other, but it is important that he believe that he was acting under a legal justification to exclude them from his home when he told them that they would not be admitted in, and when he directed Ms. Wolf not to let them in. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, I'll just ask the court to vacate his conviction and dismiss the matter. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel and take up Antonio Frank.